Hello, everybody. This is Ari Karen for Lender Legal Update. So hopefully everybody had a wonderful July 4th, and I'm sorry I've missed the last couple of these. I was on a long jury trial, and representing client on a long jury trial, and which was very successful. That was good, and just had some conflicts with dates. So I'm glad to be back and talking to all of you. There's been a lot of developments that we have not addressed, and I kind of wanted to go through some of those because I think they're really important, and I'm going to address what I think are the top three probably right now. The first one that everybody should be paying attention to is arbitration agreements. So as many of you know, the U.S. Supreme Court had an opinion, rendered an opinion about probably about a month ago at this point, where it said that arbitration agreements for employees that impose both a class waiver and arbitration are valid. It's a huge decision, especially for lenders, because as many of you also know, a big area has been wage hour compliance, so that, it was very difficult to categorize loan officers exempt or not exempt, to categorize them in all different types of ways. And so what's occurred is that the process for getting them exempt or non-exempt, it just doesn't fit really well within the Fair Labor Standards Act, and there's been lots and lots and lots of lawsuits about that. And so one strategy for companies that are especially struggling with this and have not been able to find a really good way to making people exempt or not exempt is to use these class waivers. So it's one of the things that, I really think it comes out of this decision that companies should be thinking about. So what they could essentially do now is they could use this class waiver, put in an employment agreement, get people to sign it, and the effect of it is that what occurs now is when a loan officer brings a lawsuit for wage hour, in other words, they're entitled to overtime, they were entitled to minimum wage, this arbitration class waiver limits the case to that one particular person. And so they can't form a class. And that's really where the majority of the risk comes in these types of cases, is that you've got one person who can really trigger a whole class of 500 people suing you, and that, remember, it goes back 3 years. So it isn't just your current staff. It's all your current staff and any of the turnover in the last couple of years. So a company with 50, 100 loan officers could easily have a class of 3, 4, 500 people, easily. And, you figure $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a pop per person, that adds up to a whole lot of money. So these class waivers are huge in avoiding those lawsuits, because most one-off wage hour cases for loan officers are, like I said, I'm not saying a few thousand dollars, but they're very rarely a $50,000 case, right? You're talking 10 grand, 5 grand, that's the typical case, sometimes less. So when they can't band together in a class, it just doesn't really make it worth the time for most lawyers to bring those cases. So these arbitration class waivers are a big deal. And I think the other thing is the way the Supreme Court ruled in a very definitive sense. They didn't open it up as with lots of exceptions, right? In other words, well, you can do it, but not here, here, or here, or you can do it, but you have to exactly say this. They just kind of said, you can do it. It's permissible. And so I think everybody should go back. I will tell you, for all my clients, anyone who got me to draft one, I drafted them sort of hedging bets on how this decision would go. So that it would be safe either way, but I think they could be made more potent and more effective, but certainly more potent in now the way I would draft it as opposed to the way I would have drafted it before. So if any of my clients are out there listening, one suggest is to probably get in touch with me pretty soon. I'd like to redraft your arbitration agreement. Again, what you have or what I did before works, but I was hedging bets, so I made it a little bit weaker than I would have knowing this decision. So it's a really good outcome, helps a lot of people, and really should avoid a lot of the risks associated with these types of cases. So that would be one really kind of important thing that's happened in the last couple months. So for things to do, whether I represent you and I've done these for you in the past, whether you don't have them, whether you've got another lawyer who's drafted from you and for them for you prior to this decision, a lot of people might do it differently now than they would have before when they were, for example, like myself, hedging bets on which way this decision might go. So if you haven't had that looked at, I'd strongly suggest either putting it in place, definitely, if you haven't had it, or having what you had drafted reviewed again to make sure, it gives you the most the greatest level of efficacy in cutting out these cases. So that's one thing I would do. The other thing you also want to look at when you draft these is think about the company to which you're going to send your arbitration, whether you want to select them. You really need to read the rules. Read the rules for AAA, read the rules for for JAMS. That's another one of the big arbitration companies, because some of these rules can have actually pretty big effect on who pays the costs, who doesn't pay the cost, and that can also affect how you draft your agreement. So, for example, JAMS has a rule that it says that if an employee signs an agreement and the employee has an option of signing an arbitration agreement, they'll actually make the pay employee split the cost. When you're talking about AAA, on the other hand, they just say anytime there's an employee agreement with an employer to arbitrate and it's relating to an employment matter, pretty much the employer is going to pay the full cost, even if there's a language in the agreement that says the parties are going to split. So, you got to look at these things. These aren't just, sign an agreement that somebody else had. There are some considerations that go into it. A last consideration when you deal with arbitration is who should sign them. Arbitration I don't generally like. I think that it can actually encourage the number of claims, and especially when you have specious claims. You don't need a lawyer. You can go in front of an arbitrator, take a whack at it. There aren't the procedures for summary disposition, for motions practice. A lot of arbitrators just say, come on in, let's meet, we'll decide. And the other thing is you have very, very limited rights of appeal. So, if you get a bad arbitrator as opposed to a bad judge, you really have almost no recourse. So there are reasons not to do arbitration. Having said that, if arbitration is in a zone of employees where there's risk of these class actions, that can outweigh it. So what a lot of times I'll do is I'll tell companies, listen, you should get all your loan officers to sign, an arbitration agreement, but none of your managers, none of your branch managers. And again, that isn't across the board. Every situation's different. You have to get some specific advice. But I think the point is you have to really make there is some decision-making that goes into who you give an arbitration agreement to. I would not, for instance, give it to every single employee. Generally speaking, you're not going to be dealing with class action lawsuits from every single employee. And if you put arbitration for every single employee, you're going to do a lot more arbitration and have a lot more claims. So think about who you want to arbitrate with, who you don't, and also think about, the types of claims. You may, for example, not want cases where there are issues of a fiduciary breach or issues relating to, theft of trade secrets. You may not want to arbitrate those. So there's some definite considerations that go into this. I think they are very specific to each company, but there are conversations you should have with counsel and, make some of those decisions now, because at least you know that if you do an arbitration agreement with a class waiver, you know it's going to be upheld now. And that's a big thing. So that's the first thing I wanted to cover. Second thing is to talk about the changes to Dodd-Frank. As you guys know, a new amendment was signed by Trump about a month ago, a month and a half ago, and it has a couple of key provisions I wanted to touch base on. The first one, I think, is a little bit hidden. Not a lot of people have talked about it, which is kind of interesting, but I think it could have some pretty profound effects and some big advantages to certain types of lenders and disadvantages potentially to others. That is relating to Section 101 of the Act. I think it's SR 2125, I think was the Senate bill number. But you can look it up. Trump signed it probably about a month and a half ago. And in the first section of Section 101 actually changes the definition of QM. Here's what it does. It comes out and it says, for any company that entity that is a depository and is federally insured, so you know, essentially FDIC insured. It includes credit unions also, and it also, I believe, includes state banks, assuming they were federally insured. Any of those institutions, if they originate, so they first have to originate and hold, or transfer to a similar institution a loan that they originated, those loans, if that's held by that institution, okay, which also meets the definition, it will be considered a QM loan. Now, the key is this has to be an institution that's also under $10 billion. So you're talking about much more of your community federal banks. These types of institutions, credit unions as well, can originate loans that otherwise do not meet QM, with a couple of notable exceptions I'll go into in a second, and yet they are QM loans. Now, the exceptions are they can't be interest only, they cannot be negative amortization, and they have to comply with all the prepayment penalties. Excluding those, the loans can be considered QM. They don't need to conform, for example, to Exhibit Q. So you can't do also stated. You have to have some type of documentation to back it up. But again, it doesn't have to meet Exhibit Q. So for example, now let's say you originate a loan, and that loan doesn't meet the test for DTI, right? It's a 55 DTI, and you want to do it. That's a QM loan if you hold it. Or if you transfer it to another institution that otherwise meets the definitions. So if you sold it to a bank that meets these definitions and they held it, it would still be considered a QM loan. So obviously that's a major potential, I think a potential major business advantage, because it gives you more flexibility in underwriting criteria, more flexibility in doing different types of loans, which ultimately creates a benefit for relationships with different affinity groups, whether it's builders or realtors. You know, the fact that now they can go to you and get loans done that a typical originator doesn't meet one of these definitions, that isn't a depository, for example, can't do those loans. You could, you being, you know, if you meet the definition of the applicable entity. So I think it's going to be a major advantage they can market. They will also be able to do, again, different types of loans and have more flexibility with borrowers. While that has not hit a lot, and I think it's because, again, you have to have that under $10 billion. I mean, and I think people just have not really paid attention as much to the law. But, you know, somebody's going to start doing these loans, and, you know, from perspective, they're QM. So you don't have to have that huge increase in pricing. So if you're talking about some of these borrowers that may, you know, like the doctor loans that everybody talked about, where it was difficult getting, you know, QM status, you can start doing these now and they'll be QM. So that's a pretty big change, I think, that could have some downstream effects for the industry, both in terms of, I think there's two. First, obviously the banks that do them can take advantage of it, as we talked about, from not only a one-on-one borrower perspective and getting borrowers that others can't, but also just a general relationship building perspective. I think the second area that is really critical in that is what will happen to those institutions that don't have a means to compete on these types of loans. You know, is there going to be an investor to step forward that will allow, on a non-QM basis, similar loans to be made? You know, and in terms of interest rate and things like that. So that's really something to watch to see if some type of imbalance develops between lenders who can meet these definitions of an entity that can do otherwise non-QM loans as QM and those who can't. So something to really think about. I've seen a lot of institutions recently buying banks, which I think has to do not only with this but other changes. But I do think that we're going to see some of these bank acquisitions continue to occur by lenders trying to get access. Obviously, lower margins have also spurred that on. The other major area I think to talk about is the area of transitional licensing and how that will affect things. So they did approve transitional licensing, and what there's a bunch of criteria to it, but the highlights of it are that if you are a lender who already was or is, you know, certified in the NMLS, And you go from, you know, a federally chartered institution to something that, you know, is not federally chartered, and so you don't have the preemption, then that loan officer can continue to originate loans, provided, you know, once they actually apply for their state license. So you can't just go in and automatically it exists. You have to apply. But between the time you apply and between the time you're approved, you can continue to originate loans, provided that you don't have any ineligibility criteria. In other words, you haven't been denied already in another state. I think in the last, all the details sort of, I don't have right in front of me, but I think it's in the last 12 months you haven't been denied. You don't have any excluding offenses, that is, you know, offenses that under state law would prohibit you from originating, in terms of convictions, things like that. And so as long as you meet those criteria, you can apply for, I want to say it's a period of, I don't exactly have the number of days, maybe 180 days, or it's even more than that. But it gives you plenty of time to have your application processed so that you don't go through that window. And so what I think you might see is a lot of loan officers who have been at banks where there's clearly been a barrier to entry to going into a non-bank sort of environment. That barrier is eroded now, to the point that I think you could see some bank loan officers transition over to non-bank lenders, and that flow of human capital, so to speak, will probably increase over the next, you know, several months as people have more opportunities to make changes. Obviously, it's a very different business model, you know, going from a depository, and so that could certainly dissuade some people. But in terms of hiring loan officers with experience, that's one place that non-bank lenders may want to go. So those are all, you know, three sort of big changes that are kind of hitting the industry. Another one that obviously everybody is talking about that I'll just kind of throw in because we have time is, you know, the struggle that everybody's going through with respect to margins. Lots of companies, and you know, obviously I don't know when that's going to change, when the margins are going to change. I've heard various economic reports of people saying, you know, there's indicators of a potential recession in 2019, which would obviously change interest rates and probably create, you know, a little bit more flexibility in the margins. So there are some indicators economists are talking about. In the beginning, they think, well, you know, nobody knows, this is a science. But, you know, what are things that, you know, people can do to strategies to minimize the impacts of these margins? You know, obviously one place is loan officer compensation. You know, for companies that have not, some companies have already put a lot of these things into place, others have not, and they've always had kind of a very streamlined process. But this is an area where simplicity doesn't necessarily always, is always the best rule. So consider certain things in your LO comp plans if you haven't done them already. So consider, for example, deviating between loans that are fully self-originated and loans that are originated via some type of channel or process by the lender through the lender's efforts of marketing. That's one thing you can do. Also, the more that you are helping the loan officers to originate those loans, obviously not only can you, you know, you can pay them less, of course, it's a different channel, and the LO comp rules provide for that, but obviously the greater the level of assistance and the greater the number of loans and volume, it stands to reason you can continue to pay them less. So one area I've seen certain lenders really focus on is the deployment of technology that assists not just the processing of the loans, we all know that's sort of out there, but also the actual origination of the loan, so that it's not just a matter of lead generation, it's a matter of giving loan officers leads that are much more highly qualified before the loan officer has to do anything. And so I know there are companies out there developing sort of some of those technologies, and those might be, I mean, if you're employing those, I think it's a legitimate reason that in and of itself to pay loan officers less. A lot of companies are also, and I would, you know, I don't want to go into all the details of this here. We've sort of covered it before, so I'll just highlight it, and if anyone has questions, they can come back to me and talk about it. But I see people deviating in terms of compensation on things like bond loans, in some unique circumstances, brokered loans, depending on how and when. So I think those are things you can do. And there's also companies putting together essentially programs that allow the company to reach out and try to recapture a loan when they've lost it, and creating some compensation structural differences around that. These are all pretty complicated things that, you know, nobody should sort of do on their own. You should definitely get legal counsel in setting them up. But these are things that I'm seeing people do to limit some of the compensation to loan officers, as opposed to an across-the-board cut, so that it allows them to make up for some of those differences in profitability that they're experiencing now with margins. So those are all some of the areas that I think are coming up that have been kind of hot industry topics the last, you know, 6 or 8 weeks while I've been gone. So I hope that's some useful information. If you have anything you want to reach out back to me and ask about, feel free to send me an email. I think you guys all have it, or Leslie. And I look forward to speaking to you guys next month, and hope everyone's been well and having a good summer. Thanks, everybody. Bye.